It's the one that's easily overlooked, with a very strong emphasis in the modern Vipassana tradition. It's often really just on metta alone, loving kindness, which is a marvelous focus. Or in the Mahayana tradition, we get a very strong emphasis on compassion, loving kindness too, but compassion is really, really strong. So love and compassion, and even how the words flow off the lips, love and compassion, they obviously belong to each other. And then equanimity is that which makes unconditional love, unconditional compassion. So that's kind of the backup to make sure that it's authentic, that the love is not simply an expression of attachment, and that the compassion is not simply an expression of sadness. So it's easy to overlook the third one, almost like four siblings, and the third one kind of gets easily overlooked, right? But I think it's, how do you say, very important, and I think it's always been important. But for us living in modernity, and I think that's all of us here, especially important, especially timely, and for a couple of reasons. I'll come back to the mantra from William James: for the moment what we attend to is reality. And it's perfectly obvious to all of us that what the media, the various news services over the internet, newspapers, television, radio, and so on, it's perfectly obvious that the great majority of the news that is being presented to us is negative. It's misery and it's evil. It's corruption, it's abuse, it's sexual scandals, it's greed, it's all that kind of stuff, anger, hatred, fanaticism, and then just natural calamities. Okay, the volcano spewing out all this ash out of Iceland, one thing after another. And so, what is it, 90%, 95% of the news is bad. And people have tried, at least on one occasion, to have a news service that just focused on good news, and people didn't want to watch it. One would think, oh, really, great idea. But in fact, that doesn't sell. And I'll just spend a very short time on this. I mean, it's kind of bizarre. What do we have, a masochistic society here? And I think not. I think perhaps is only one diagnosis, is that from this evolutionary perspective, for us to survive, to make it through the day, to make it through the year, what we really need to be alerted to is not the good news. The good news is fine, but yeah, so, okay. But what's the bad news, you know? For us to survive, to make it through, to meet the challenges of the day, what people really want to know about is what the bad news. And then give us the little ice cream at the end. You know, give us a little good news at the end, but first give it to us straight. What's the bad stuff happening so I can prepare, I can get braced? So that's one diagnosis, because it is kind of bizarre. Why do people want to listen? And it's clearly, it is people-driven. It's not just capitalism or governments that are forcing us to listen to bad news. They will sell us what we want to buy. And there it is. But the result of all of this, by way of all of the media, is that our vision of what's taking place in the globe is about 95% negative. Is that now samsara is an ocean of suffering? Okay, maybe that's just being realistic. But what never gets covered is, when have you ever seen a headline, mother shows extraordinary love and generosity towards her children? Okay, that's nice, you know, but it's happening every single day. How many women drown their children in the bathtub? How many children are giving their children really loving baths in the bathtub? We just don't hear about the little kids having a really fun bath, you know, with a mother just loving them to bits. Not literally, you know, just loving them a lot. And so we don't get a balanced picture. And so because of this, because of the type of exposure we're getting, it's just very easy to, for the moment, what we attend to is reality. We're not, unless you're clairvoyant and you really do have a global vision psychically of what's taking place, we're getting it by the way of the media, and the media are giving us a massively negative tilt to what's happening in the world today. And we may need to balance that out. I think it's probably helpful. Since we won't get it by way of the media, then we have to be selective, not to put on rose-tinted glasses, to put on a happy smile, and isn't the world a lovely place, in some type of a foolish or superficial fashion, but simply because we are having a bright light shining on the evil and the suffering in the world. And that is an aspect of reality, but there's also tremendous virtue and there's also tremendous joy in the world too. And we're not getting that. Overall, we're not getting that. And so to be realistic, to balance out by way of empathetic joy. And the term mudita in Sanskrit and Pali, or gawa in Tibetan, just means joy, delight. Delight's probably the best word. It just means delight. Okay? Taking delight in something. Taking delight in something. And so, in this regard, since we are running a great new experiment on ourselves, in terms of the modern media, then to balance out what is a very, very imbalanced view of what's taking place in the world, mudita, or empathetic joy, can be just what the doctor ordered. And that is to deliberately attend to, how do you say, embodiments of virtue, experiences of joy in the world, and attend to them and respond in the natural way. So there's one reason that mudita, or empathetic joy, is really very, very timely, very important in today's world, more so than 100 years ago, 500 years ago, or in most of human history, when people would travel no more than maybe 10 kilometers or 10 miles from their home. So there we are. So there's one good reason. Another good reason, I could go on and on and on, but I'll try to be very concise. And it is a characteristic primarily of the West, so Euro-America, but it's becoming, I think, more global now just because of globalization by way of the media. And that is issues of low self-esteem. See how many words we can come up with. Self-hatred, low self-esteem, self-contempt, lack of self-worth. Any other words? Self-loathing. Self-loathing, that rolls right off the tongue. Self-loathing, anything else? Guilt. There we go, there's a big one. Guilt. Just guilt, that I'm just feeling guilty. And why? Because I'm just not a good person. I've just done so many bad things that I'm just one of those bad people. Unlike some of those people out there, but I'm one of the bad ones. And so that whole, that's a nest. That's a cluster. They all belong together. And guilt is really crucial. Really crucial. Well, people throughout history, East and West, have felt guilty. Sometimes they feel, you know, low self-esteem. They feel kind of like a loser, that they're not living up to their own or other people's expectations. It happens globally. But it really looks like Europe took out a franchise on it. You know, like was looking for monopoly, like, okay, we own this. And it's coming out of various sources, the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, both of those, original sin. We got that from the Jewish tradition. And then the notion that Christ had to die that horrible death, and frankly, because we're so awful, that he had to go under that to save us from our awful sins, because really, we're so awful and he's so perfect, and therefore, just remember. And I was just teaching at St. Joseph's at a convent in Sydney, and boy, you couldn't walk down a hallway without seeing one more. You know, it's kind of a reminder, this is how bad you are. This perfect man had to suffer this because of you. I'm sorry. You just kind of want to go, sorry, 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 you know. You know. And so we're getting it from those two traditions, and then we get it from evolutionary biology, that after all, you're just an animal. And really all you're doing is just, it boils down to survival and procreation. So yeah, do all the lovey-dovey business, I want to serve humanity, but what you really want to do is survive and procreate. And so that kind of notion that, you know, I've heard one very good philosopher, a prominent philosopher, we're just animals. We're just animals. He almost like get angry. We're just animals. And that's it. Oh, okay. Arf, arf. Yeah. I'll try to live down to your expectations. Okay, where can I mate? Where can I mate? It's not very uplifting, you know. And then we have Freud coming in. If you really want to make your day, read Freud. And you'll learn that all love is simply an expression of libido. So Albert Schweitzer, Mother Teresa, Dalai Lama, it's just a basically libido getting expressed in a tricky way. Okay? And that really, we're basically, and we are really indelibly neurotic. We don't have to be pathological, we don't have to be psychotic, but we should really be content with a manageable degree of neurosis. And just don't expect too much. Don't get your expectations too high, because fundamentally, you're screwed up. But cope. You know. So we got that from psychiatry, we get it from biology, we get it from Judaism, we get it from Christianity. That's really a gangbang. That's really coming together. That's a lot of a reinforcement. Is I kind of thought I was a schmuck. Now I know I'm a schmuck. In every possible way, philosophical, spiritual, biological, personality, psychological. Oh, I'm really one sad cookie. You know? So not much uplifting there. And we'll get the notion of, again, redemption, of possibility of being good, is coming from radically outside. Jesus, that other person, died for your sins, and therefore, because of his radical otherness, he's totally pure and you're really schmucky. It comes from outside. We get it from the pharmaceutical industry that you're really screwed up, but take this pill. Take this pill, and this will manage your screwed up symptoms. It won't heal you because you can't be healed because you're really screwed up. But take this and it'll manage the symptoms and just keep on buying it. You know, so whatever it is, it really looks like there's not a lot of hope in here, and we have to look for something radically outside of ourselves to even get by. So this is an experiment too, being run on humanity, and it's not global. I said I'd be short here. I'm going to be not that short, but a little bit more. But some of you might recall this become a pretty well-known anecdote, 1990, third Mind and Life meeting. When the Dalai Lama learned for the first time, really, I think he got it. He grokked it. What's the meaning of guilt? And what's the meaning of low self-esteem? Because he really didn't get it. And Sharon Salzberg was there at that meeting, very, very well-known, very beloved, a Vipassana teacher. She was the one that raised this. So I won't tell the whole story. But as the interpreter, one of two interpreters for this whole encounter of the Dalai Lama learning, what is self-contempt, self-loathing, low self-esteem? What is the referent? Is this real? And when he finds it took him a while. He's not an unintelligent man, but he had no feeling for it. I think just no feeling, like, oh yeah, I get it. I remember what that's like. And when he got it, what is this self-contempt, self-loathing, low self-esteem? Then he turned to the whole group of monks. There must have been 20 of them. And he turned to them in Tibetan. And he said, this is what these Western people are talking about. How many of you have experienced that? And the monks look at each other. You know, no comprende. Like, they didn't connect with it either. So when he got it, when he really got, you mean this is real, then he turned to all the Westerners in the room. There must have been 80 people, the core participants, and then a lot of audience. And he turned to all the Westerners in the room. And said, how many of you experience low self-esteem, self-loathing, sense of guilt, and so forth? It was like a forest of hands went up, like every single, and then he would, you know, he was really shocked, like, is this contagious? You know, is this something only white people get? Maybe if you have brown skin, you're okay, you know. Oh, yeah.
Let me interrupt you.
Sure, you can. But I'll just need to clip this, let's see.
Et voilà.
So the point here is, that this is one more experiment we're running on ourselves, of this whole issue of low self-esteem. I remember when I was a monk, this will be the last story, then we'll get to the meditation, but when I was a monk, quite young monk, 23 or so, I think it was quite early in my formal monastic training, in a monastery in Dharamsala, the Buddhist school of dialectics, and I went to the abbot, who was incredibly loving man, superb teacher, Genlo Sangyatso. He was so wonderful. And he loved teaching, he loved the Dharma, and he loved his students. And so everything, whenever he taught, it was just an expression of love. It was really a wonderful teacher. But on one occasion, but he was also our Lama. And so I went and spoke with him once, and on many occasions, but on one occasion I said, Genna, which means teacher, I said, you know, I really spent a lot of time dwelling on my own faults. I can't remember exactly what the question was, but I'm really, you know, I spent a lot of really time just thinking about my own defects, mental afflictions. And he looked at me with this incredibly sweet smile and said, nah. No, you don't. Yeah, really, I do. Because the Tibetan thing is that we focus on the faults of other people, whereas we think of ourselves as really good. That's normal. That's normal mental affliction. I'm good, other people are not so good. Okay, that's kind of normal. It's pride, it's arrogance, it's clinging to our views, my virtues, my, and other people don't quite, you know, at least some people, they're not quite as good as me. That's fairly normal throughout human society. But the notion of really focusing on one's own defects and feeling I'm really probably not as good as most people I encounter, or here's one way of phrasing it, and it really has a lot of punch to it. If people knew me better, they would like me less. That notion. And if people knew me really well, they won't want to have anything to do with me at all. They'll treat me like I have rabies. That notion, that's really alien to these more traditional cultures. Whereas I think a lot of you, when I said that, it rang a bell, something of a bell. Yeah? So, end of story then. For this reason, this is anomalous. This is not characteristic of human beings throughout all of human history, East and West. This is one more of those anomalies that we have in modernity. And so how do we balance that out? To attend to and be very honest with respect to our own mental afflictions, our misdeeds on occasion. Very important. It's part of self-honesty. But to then, when we do something kind, something that's simply good, that is selfless, that is altruistic, something that is meaningful and so forth, and not even attend to it, say, well, whatever, that was... Because I've seen people like this. One of the most sincere Dharma practitioners I know. And she's very loving, she's generous with her time, she will really go out of her way to help other people. And I've seen it, I know this is true. She regards herself as just being really the bottom of the pile. Terrible practitioner, really unworthy, is almost embarrassed to write me for advice because I'm really wasting your time, this kind of thing. So her perception of herself and my perception of her, very, very different. And I don't have any special attachment for her, I just simply observe, you know. She's a very nice person, very dedicated, but she's walking around with a 50 kilogram backpack of low self-esteem and guilt. And this sense, you know, I'm really a disappointment. Really a disappointment. So I just try to encourage her to keep on throwing off that backpack, because I don't think anybody else shares that view. So how to throw off the backpack of this kind of burden of guilt and all the rest of it. Da, 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 da. You know, the doctor to the rescue. Mudita. Taking delight in our own joys, taking delight in our own virtues. And here's the point, and this is how we make sure it doesn't turn into poison. In this practice that we're just about to go into, the focus is on the success, the joys, the virtues, the goodness that people bring. It is focusing on that. And of course, the people are not totally dissociated from that. But it's really focusing on the virtue, the success, the joy. And so if this is legitimate, to take delight in others' virtues, to take delight in others' happiness, their successes, and so forth, then it's equally legitimate to take delight in our own joys, our own successes, our own virtues. It's what it is not, when practiced correctly, it's not self-congratulation. It's not, boy, am I a great person. I am really something special. I am really, wow, I am really amazing. That's just ego. That's nothing to cultivate. But it's not focusing on, whoa, look at me. I am. That's not the focus. The focus is, look at the deed. Look at the motivation. Look at the joy. Look at the virtue. And virtue is virtue. So we heard this statement, suffering has no owner. Maybe virtue has no owner either. Virtue is just virtue. And whoever happens to be, you know, bringing it to the world, well, thank you very much for conveying it into the world, but take delight in virtue, even if it happens to be virtue that you've conveyed into the world. So, that's some of the rationale why this is so timely, very important, and it's one that we can really bring into daily life. You don't have to seek out a cave and deep solitude and all of that to practice mudita. You can do this while living with a family, in the workplace, keeping eyes open, attending to the virtue, the kindness, the happiness, and so forth in the world. Attending to it, make it real, and rejoice in it. Okay? So there's a thumbnail sketch. Third of the four immeasurables. You ready to go? Okay, let's have one 24-minute session. And always we begin in the same way, with this act of kindness, this soothing act of letting your awareness descend into and fill the space of the body. This quiet space, non-conceptual, silent, soothing and comforting. As soon as you bring the awareness into the body, let this immediately catalyze the release of tension, the softening of muscles, the setting of your body at ease, in stillness and in vigilance. Settle your respiration in its natural rhythm, unforced, effortless, and unimpeded. And set your mind at ease, letting it gradually settle in stillness and unveil its natural luminosity as you attend for a little while to the sensations of the in and out flow of the breath, relaxing with every out breath, arousing and focusing your attention with each in breath. And now let's expand the scope of our awareness. And specifically for those of us here in the Mind Center in Phuket, I'll focus the first part of this meditation on our own unique circumstances here, but parallels can certainly be found elsewhere. So this meditation is not only relevant for us here and now. As I'm sure you've all done multiple times already over the past week that you've been here, attend closely to this environment that's been created for us. Just let your mind dwell on all the love and all the intelligence, all the foresight, all the loving concern that's gone into creating this environment for us to come and have the most conducive, conceivable environment that money can buy, that art and talent, creativity, engineering, technology, the comfort of this room with its air conditioning, the spaciousness, the light coming in, the audio system so that we can all hear, our rooms with the comfort, the clear design, the delicious food, the security, knowing that we are safe as can be. Take delight in the vision of the one man who above all is responsible for this, our benefactor, our dear friend, Klaus Heaven. Without him, this simply would not be here. It is his vision, and he made it financially possible. He alone. But of course, he's not a contractor, he's not a builder, he's not a cook, he's not a gardener, interior decorator, he's not a guard. So all of these other people who have come together, many of them quite consciously, knowing what this is about, taking delight in it, wanting to offer their best, to create an environment that is as conducive as possible for spiritual practice, for people to cultivate their hearts and minds and find genuine happiness. Just about everyone here, even to the gardeners, knows what this is about. They could have found other employment, almost certainly, but they chose to work here. Right down to the people who are planting the grass and watering it, and those working every day for the surrounding environment to make this just the most wonderful synthesis of cultivation of the body, of the mind, the spirit. Take it all in. And take delight, satisfaction, appreciation. And gratitude. And once again, if you will, imagine this radiant orb of light at your heart, the deepest dimension, one that is pure primordial goodness. It is the very wellspring of virtue, the ultimate source of genuine happiness, a dimension of your own being, never contaminated by the afflictions of the mind, Imagine this symbolically, and with each out-breath, breathe out your delight, your appreciation, your satisfaction. Breathe out your joy and your gratitude. This environment has been in the planning for 2 years. How many people, seen and unseen, most of them unseen, have contributed their time, their effort, their ingenuity, their skills to make this a reality today? How many strangers on this island of Phuket have actually contributed, but you may never meet them, and certainly never know that they did contribute? How many people from abroad contributed the supplies, the materials? Strangers amongst us who created this wonderful environment for us. And imagine this pure, radiant white light flowing in from your heart and touching each one, as if you could meet each one face to face and express your delight and appreciation. Imagine now all the people who contribute to making every meal, 3 wonderful meals here a day. The grain, the vegetables. Even the animals that sacrifice their lives, obviously not voluntarily. But may that sacrifice, may it turn to greater good. That we repay the kindness by applying ourselves single-pointedly to practice, trying to bring the greatest good to this world that we can. All those who were involved in transporting the food, cooking the food, delivering it with such graciousness and conscientiousness and care, cleaning up after us. We don't even have to clean our own dishes. Those who wash our clothes. Some people perhaps regard gratitude as a burden. Oh, now I'm in debt. Now I have to pay back. I have to think about this. How can I pay back the debt, so I don't need to feel grateful anymore that we're even? Such a sad attitude. Wear the garment of gratitude like a warm jacket in a cold climate. Joyful gratitude. And truly taking delight in others' service, their goodness, their hard work. But now let's shift the focus. What would this be if people like us were not here? It would be a very nice hotel. That's it. A very secure, well-designed hotel with a really good restaurant. Look at the good you have brought to it. That each of us here individually and we collectively take delight now in your own motivation for coming here. Traveling the long distance, settling in, and applying yourself to the cultivation of virtue, your hearts and minds. Each of us here, I think quite genuinely, wishing to be better people, with greater mental balance, wisdom, compassion. It's time to take delight. Take satisfaction in your own and everyone else's practice here. We've all come for something good, and with the aspiration to bring something good back to the world. How noble, how truly wonderful. Breathe out this light of appreciation, of delight, of joy. And let this light suffuse the whole room. Our being here is what this whole facility was created for, that people like us may devote themselves to cultivating their hearts and minds. We make it worthwhile. This is what Klaus had in mind, and so many other people who joined efforts to create this environment. As they delight in our being here, share that delight. Then, like a supernova, let this light from your heart expand in all directions. How many other people here, not just here, but elsewhere on this island, in Thailand, in Southeast Asia, how many other people around the world are taking time out each day, really cultivating their hearts and minds, doing their best to bring the greatest good they can to the world, to alleviate suffering, to bring joy. Expand the field of your awareness to all these kindred souls. Religious and non-religious, old and young. take delight in others' joys and in the causes of joy. Let your awareness embrace the world and share your light. Let it mingle with the light of others. And utterly release all appearances, all objects to the mind. Let your awareness completely come to rest. Come and descend into its own place. And let your awareness know itself. Just rest in the knowing of knowing. Let's bring the session to a close. So, on a very practical note, I'm getting much less reverberation. Is it still clear? Did you do something, Danielle? I think you must have. No? To my ears, my voice is now much clearer. How is it, Rosa? Was it clear? Was it okay? It's okay, yeah? And in the back, Vincent? Jolly good. Yeah, it's better for my ears that it's not so whoa, 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 whoa. So, maybe it's just my imagination. Jolly good. So, questions, comments, insights? Yes. Ricardo.
Thank you. So about the practice of observing the breath, sensation of the breath in the nostrils.
Yes.
I feel like sometimes when I'm, you know, the instructions are we are to relax when we breathe out, and raise the attention when we breathe in. But somehow I am realizing that when I breathe in and I try to arouse the attention, I am doing something, but I am it's making me tense somehow. Not too much, but but I can tell over in the longer practices now, I can tell that I am tightened up.
So
I don't know if you could give me some tips.
Sure. I don't want you to tighten up. Surprise. So for the time being, don't arouse, just relax. And try, but and here in this way though, and that is like a continuous thread, like just an ongoing flow, quite even, not surging, not going up and down, just an even flow. Relax with every out-breath. So continue doing that. Relax muscular tension here in the shoulders, the face, the eyes. Relax with every out-breath. With every out-breath, release any thoughts, images, and so forth that comes up. So continue with that. And then when you come to the very end of the out-breath, continue to release until the next breath just flows in effortlessly, right? But now, what it can be continuous here, in this overall ambience of release, releasing both during out-breath as well as releasing during in-breath. So it's like you're just being dished up the next in-breath. You don't have to pull it. It just flows in, right? So see if you can sustain with just an even flow the awareness of the breathing. So as you're breathing out, not going spacey or getting a bit unhinged or disengaged, but very gently, like holding a thread between two fingers. It really doesn't take much effort. But if you become absent-minded or forget about it, the fingers can part and then it's dropped. But you don't need to press. You don't need to be tight. But you need to hold just tight enough. So see if you can sustain with just that tight enough the awareness, the ongoing flow of awareness as you breathe out. And then as the breath just flows in, without arousing, just sustain that same even flow of the sensations of the breath. So that you have a sense of just an ongoing even flow of mindfulness, of the ongoing unbroken flow of the sensations of the breath. Okay, so just maintain evenness. The whole issue of arousing and releasing, actually it's a temporary method anyway. You're not going to do that when you're on stage 8 or 9, when you're really advanced. You won't need to. What you know therefore is the release is to overcome excitation, the arousal to overcome laxity, yeah? But for the time being, just focus. We haven't even quite finished 1 week, you know? By 7 o'clock, we will have finished 1 week already. Only 7 to go, right? But still, only 1 week, so you have 7 more to go. And so, as you apply antidote for the laxity. It wasn't me. I don't know what that was. But it's gone. As you apply the remedy for laxity, just see that it's very gentle. It's a gentle arousal. Okay? But what you don't want to do, and this is why I went in at some length, what you don't want to do is don't make a habit of getting tight. Because we already have it. This is how we get things done in the world. We try really hard, we bunch, we contract, you know, we grit our teeth and so forth. Now it's time to break that habit and not reinforce it in any way. This is loose. It doesn't mean sloppy, it doesn't mean slack, but it means loose, and out of that looseness, the stability. And that's really the sweetness of the shamatha practice, that the mind does get stable, the mind does calm down, but not with a fist, but with an open hand. Settling. Okay? Yes, Teresa.
Alan, in the Shavasana, lying position.
The Shavasana, yes.
Shavasana.
Yes.
The tongue must
maybe
be placed.
Maybe a bit farther from your mouth, because I'm getting a lot of repercussion. Just
here?
Let's try that.
Here?
That sounds good. Okay, now let's try.
The tongue must be placed behind the teeth, or can be relaxed too?
Wherever the tongue wants to go, just let it go there.
Okay, that's right. That's what I was needing.
We can have a new practice. Settle the body, speech, and mind, and your tongue.
Okay.
In its natural, it's a natural state.
Thank you.
Whatever feels most natural. Yeah, nothing can try. So you don't have to make a point. We do get this in the very, very formal position. There's nothing wrong with this. There's no criticism. But in the very formal posture, sitting, you know, in full lotus, for example, then the tongue, I'm sure you've heard, touches the back of the teeth, the palate. It's tucked up a little bit. Supine position, just let it be. No big deal. Okay? Good. Anything else coming up? Elizabeth.
I'm having a lot of problem with endless commentary on the practice.
in the endless commentary in the practice.
Yes, uh-huh. Endless until I want to say, shut up.
Yeah, that'll help.
It won't help, I know.
It's actually more commentary, isn't it?
Yes. And it's mostly negative commentary.
Here's what you could try. Shut up. No, you shut up. You shut up. I said it first. No, I said it louder. You shut up. You shut up. That, you could try that. Or you could just breathe out with a happy smile. You don't have to, you know, put on a big happy smile, but that sense, oh, what a relief. Just in that. Just, it's just release. Like, what? It's a sigh of relief, you know. That sure, all you have here is habit. That's all it is. It's just habit. I don't think it's even good for us from an evolutionary perspective to go blah, 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 blah all day. You know, what? How does that help us survive or procreate? I don't think so. It's just a bad habit. But bear in mind, it's not getting stronger. Your being here is not making this obsessive compulsive mind become more obsessive or more compulsive.
It feels as though it is. That's the point. Especially the negative commentary feels it's increased a lot since I got here.
What I would suggest is that it's not being reinforced here, but the tendencies that were there all along are now becoming manifest. Yeah? Because you're not getting any encouragement from me to judge yourself, to crack the whip and so forth, or from anybody here, or from the staff. And so what's coming up is, and a number of people have commented this to me, but in different ways, and here's your own expression of it, you're dredging your psyche. You're doing the practice. You have been here for a week and doing a lot of practice. What happens when you do a lot of shamatha practice, especially of this sort? You dredge the psyche. And tendencies that were already there come to the light of consciousness. So you can evaluate for yourself. Do you have any history of being really stern and judging yourself and putting yourself down? Has that ever happened before? And so there it is. It's already there. It's already there. And so now is a time that you can turn the corner. You can turn the corner. See, the energy of that, the power, the momentum and inertia of the self-commentary, the judging, you're not doing it well enough, you're wasting your time, you're probably a big disappointment to everybody if they knew how poorly you're actually practicing. You'd be embarrassment. We'd have to put you in a corner with a dunce cap on, you know, that kind of thing. Because you're just not as good as anybody else here. That kind of ridiculous talk, you know, because it's, when I say it, it's just so obvious. Where did you come up with that? It's so silly. It's just so silly, you know. And so the momentum's already there. And so it basically, it's gotten as strong as it can. Now, if you wanted to reinforce it, if you wanted to have a self-recrimination, self-loathing, and self-contempt workshop, we could make it stronger. I could help. You know, if you really wanted to juice it up, I mean, I could give you a good pep talk to make you feel really, really low, you know. But that's not what we're here for. And therefore, the mental affliction, and this is just a mental affliction, is not going to get any stronger here. Right? Why should it? There's just nothing here to reinforce that mental affliction. What can get stronger here? The sense of kindness for yourself, the sense of soothing, sense of release, of relaxation, taking delight in your motivation, which is really good. It is. It's really good. And there's been a lot of that in this lifetime. You don't always focus on it. But I'm not praising you, I'm just telling you, you know, you have gray hair and you have really good motivation. Those are two equally true statements, right? And so here you are with a wonderful motivation, really quite noble. And now you're rallying your troops to overcome this habit here. So here you are actively cultivating it, and I very much doubt you're going to stop when you leave here in 7 weeks. You're not going to say, oh, that was an interesting time, but now I'm going to try self-loathing again, you know? So if I were a betting man, I would say, all right, Elizabeth now is really cultivating her mind, and there's a concerted effort, and it's sustained, and it's got a lot of motivation behind it. Develop a deeper sense of calm, to release the obsessive compulsive flow, to release the self-judgment, apply the practices for the cultivation of four immeasurables and shamatha, and that's going to get stronger. Why shouldn't it? I mean, it's just natural. It's going to get stronger. That's what happens when you devote a lot of energy to it. That's going to get stronger and stronger. But this is not going to get stronger. Because you're not doing one 8 weeks of shamatha and then 1 8-week course on self-loathing. Then it would all balance out. So you're going to win. That's what I'm saying. You're going to win. They have a lot of power here, but it's old power. And it's nothing fresh about it. And moreover, you see through it. You see through it. It's really just toxic. There's nothing good about it. Doesn't help you, doesn't help anybody else. So you see through it, you recognize the enemy as the enemy. There are afflictions of the mind that don't help us. They toxify us. So bet on yourself. Bet on yourself. You're going to win. How long? Well, that'll work itself out. But you're on a winning streak to overcome the mental afflictions of your own mind. So one more thing to take delight in. And slowly, slowly. I remember years ago when I was in the monastery in Switzerland, I'd been practicing quite diligently. I became a monk. I wasn't doing anything besides, you know, trying to focus my whole life on practicing Dharma. So maybe about 1978 or so. So I've been practicing, studying quite diligently for 8 years. And I remember one day just getting really discouraged. I saw some mental affliction come up. And it was kind of like seeing how raw, how crude, how coarse, just ugh. I saw it come up and just really like, yeah. And I thought, that's like I've never practiced Dharma in my life. Having that come up after 8 years of practice. Like, geez, does this never end? And I went into Geshe Rabdin. I was kind of like in the boo-hoo mode. Like, oh, these mental afflictions really suck. They really suck. I'm not getting anywhere. My mind really stinks, you know. And Geshe Rabdin, Rabdin means very firm. He was the very firm Geshe. He was really tough, very loving, very compassionate. But he was not gushy-gushy. He wasn't that way. And so I came in boo-hoo mode. Oh, Gena, Geshe-la, my mental afflictions are so strong. It feels like they're never going to go away. They're really oppressive. I'm just feeling blah, like my practice is not working. He just kind of looked at me and said, you've had a long time to get used to your mental afflictions. There's a long habit there. So keep practicing. You know, that's it. There's an enormous amount of habituation behind mental afflictions. That's what makes them so strong. But if you're practicing Dharma, they're going to lose. So just maintain continuity. He just told me, stiff upper lip. Carry on. Rabdin, be very firm. Just be relentless and never lose heart. The Dalai Lama said on this comment also, facing, you know, how many years is it now? It's really before 1950. No, it's about 1950 when the Chinese communist invasion just began in Tibet. And there he was at the age of 15, literally made head of state. Can you imagine? What were you doing when you were 15? Probably not governing a country. But it was not simple. They needed a Dalai Lama. They did not need a regent who commanded nothing like the loyalty, the faith, the devotion, the allegiance that the Dalai Lama does. So at the age of 15, he got, you know, looped right up to become head of state. And so since 1950, that is, well, of course, I was born that year, 60 years. 60 years of really trying to do something ever so simple is establish human rights, self-determination, some meaningful degree of cultural autonomy for the people of Tibet. And that's all the people of Tibet, Amdo, Kham, Central, Western Tibet, all ethnic Tibetans. It's something so simple. And one could say, that's all you want? You just want to be able to preserve your own cultural heritage, have some self-determination, have your own schools, your own way of life, and not have it take... That's what you want? One could imagine what sane person would be against that. I think that's a really good rhetorical question. But we know how little success, on some level, he's had. 60 years of striving. 60 years. And they still demonize him. They still call him, you know, splittist and all these ridiculous little, I don't know, nasty little, I mean, it's like kids calling each other names in a playground, the kind of epithets that are thrown at him by the government. And yet he made this comment that if you lose hope, then it's hopeless. If you lose hope, then it's hopeless. And so whatever it is, however long it may take, just maintain the strength of the heart. Whether it's trying to work for the human rights of the Tibetan people and the harmony of the Tibetan people with the Chinese people, that they can live together in harmony, mutual respect, mutual concern and care. That's the aspiration, you know. But just never losing heart. And even if it looks really dark, just cherish that strength of your heart at all times. You lose that, then it's hopeless. So hold to that and guard it. Yeah. I think he really knows what he's talking about. You know, 60 years of striving for one thing, still no success in sight. But I'm never, well, he does get discouraged on occasion, but he doesn't stay there. He doesn't stay there. He rebounds. Amazing. So, good. Yeah. Yes, Mary.
Something occurred to me today which might be helpful to Elizabeth. I've had an affliction coming up, which is a propensity for imagining negative outcomes.
Yeah.
And today, this is something that I've seen many, many times. And today I realized that's all it can do. It can't create a negative outcome. Mm-hmm. And it's just, the storyline changes, but it's the same thing over and over again, like a really bad sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very helpful for me. It took a lot of the power mm-hmm. out of it. And I thought, that's it? That's all you've got?
That's your best shot? Yeah.
And it's a really sticky affliction because it comes up and poof, it makes a, there's a big story.
Yeah.
But it's never right.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I just thought that might be helpful.
Very helpful. And the broader context for what you just shared, which I think is very meaningful, is the broader context is becoming lucid with respect to our own thoughts. And the parallel with a lucid dream is really, really strong. So I think it's Tsongkhapa, the great 14th, 15th century Tibetan master, said the easiest way, not the most robust way, but the easiest way to recognize the dream as a dream, to become lucid, is to have a really awful dream, nightmare. And it's so awful and it's so bizarre. You know, throngs of crocodiles coming into your bedroom. Doesn't happen every day. You know, should it happen, you're probably dreaming. You know, so but having one of these really bizarre, really weird, yucky, awful dreams, and he said that's the easiest way because it gets so nasty and so weird, those two, that there's kind of like recoil, and this must be a dream. This is a dream. Good, I'm out of here. And, you know, hit the ejector button and you just wake up. So that's how a lot of people have their first lucid dreams, by having a really nasty one, recognizing it's a dream, and then just making the quick decision, if this is a dream, then I'm finished, you know. But it's recognizing the dream as the dream, recognizing the nightmare as a nightmare, and that's what you were having in the waking state. It was a waking nightmare, a waking nasty dream, and then simply recognizing that's all it is. It's just the stuff that dreams are made out of. It has no more tangibility than that. And just seeing through it is already right there, the key to liberation. Yeah. So very useful, very useful. Good. Yes, Stacy first, and then back to Nathan.
You suggest the Vass breathing for settling the mind in the natural state, but not for mindfulness of breathing. And I'm wondering, does it inhibit mindfulness of breathing?
I don't think it would necessarily inhibit. I guess I'm conservative at heart, and that is, I teach with a lot of confidence, and I do that. I try to teach that which I'm confident about, and not go out on limbs. And so when I'm teaching mindfulness of breathing, with the preamble of doing the Shavasana to mellow out, to do the remedial work, you know, to get mellow, and then the belly breathing, well, that's taught in Burma for, I think, some centuries. It's been taught in the Zen tradition for some centuries, so that's not experimental. But then the long term here, well, that's really classic. That goes back at least 2,000 years or so. So then I teach with a lot of confidence. That's a tried and true method. That really works, right? With no adornment, that's it. And then likewise, when we come to settling the mind, this Vass breathing is taught by one of the great masters. I mean, he really knows what he's talking about. I've tried it also, didn't see any problem with it. And there's been no problem in applying that also to awareness of awareness. But now if I take that practice, which is coming out of the Tibetan tradition, really primarily the Dzogchen tradition, with a strong valence of Vajrayana around it, with the nadis, the chakras, and all of that business. If I should take that and then insert that over into mindfulness of breathing, now suddenly I don't have quite so much confidence. I think, oh, I've done something really innovative here. Without it, this worked really well. And it worked well for probably 2,500 years, generation after generation. Now Alan Wallace comes in and says, well, you guys may have been succeeding, but let's try it this way. Then I just don't have that much confidence. So I think one reason that I've not wanted to mess with it, you know, just it works, don't fix it, right, is that if one's doing that, to some extent, and I say even this with some uncertainty, I'm just not sure, I'll say this, it may be just fine. It may be fine, you know. But I think one bit of uncertainty is that by holding that, is that splitting the attention with something that is about the breath. I think I've just identified why I didn't want to do it. And that doesn't mean that it's clearly not the thing to be done, that it's really a bad thing to do. I don't have that confidence. But I think I just came to my mind where I didn't want to teach it. And that is when settling the mind in its natural state, you're doing your best to focus entirely on the space of the mind and its contents, and that does not include the belly. So the belly just does its own thing, but it's not where you're focusing attention. And likewise, awareness of awareness. It's just not there. It's not attending to the body at all. So as much as possible, you just let the Vass breathing go on autopilot. Just like riding a bicycle. When you really learn how, you just don't have to think about your legs. You can really be quite disconnected from your legs, and they'll still just keep on going out of habit, and the bicycle will go ahead. So that's how it is. This is like a bicycle. Once you've learned the method, then it just carries on. In mindfulness of breathing, you are attending to the breath until the acquired sign occurs. And where, in terms of the long-term practice, where are you focusing? Here, at the apertures of the nostrils. But now you're doing something down at the belly as well. Since this is the breath, this is the breath, there's going to be a big temptation to split and to be running back and forth, to Pakistanize, in the early days when there was East Pakistan and West Pakistan, to Pakistanize your mindfulness of breathing practice. So you're going to go up here, and oh, how are you doing? Okay, you still going okay? Oh, okay, good. Yeah. And then, you know, running back and forth between here and here, because they're both about the breath, and they're both about tactile sensations. So I think that's why I haven't taught it, because I just don't want people to start doing a little, running back and forth, or splitting the attention back and forth, but be single-pointed and focusing here.
Because I do find that once I start to relax with the Vass breathing, it relaxes this area.
Yeah.
And so if I continue with mindfulness of breathing and continue relaxing,
yeah,
it just feels...
So here's what I would suggest. And that is, if you're focusing there already, in the Burmese technique, the Zen technique, focusing on the hara, for a while, it's not the culminating phase of mindfulness of breathing, but these Zen practitioners, these pretty formidable Burmese monks, they didn't just dream this up for no good reason. If that's where you're focusing already, and then in this very light touch, and I think you have that down already, I'm surmising, but there's nothing forced there, but just... Well, now there's no split. You're not trying to come up here, not going back and forth. So for that phase of mindfulness breathing, and now I can't see any reason why not to do it. And that is the idea, that it releases the thorax, it releases the whole abdomen, releases the diaphragm, just gets... You don't have a jelly belly. Your constitution is not of that sort, but you want to feel like you have a jelly belly. Okay? Some people actually have one already, like I'm working on it. You're not working on it. But you have that sense of real softness, jelly, like just jelly down there, even if it's very slender. But it's just the opposite of tummy in, chest out, and breathe as if you're strangulating. You know it from yoga. It's jelly belly, really soft breathing. So that would be my response. If you're doing it focusing there, no problem. Okay? You're welcome. Back to Nathan.
I Okay. My question was about the substrate consciousness in settling the mind in its natural state. And I was just wondering when, like today when we were going over the space in between the thoughts, I've been having a few of those, you know, moments of just space, kind of empty
right.
space.
Right.
But most of the time it's the remote control, click, click, click.
Yeah.
But when we're in that space itself, are we in the substrate consciousness then, or is the substrate consciousness a level deeper than that, or is that the substrate consciousness itself when we're in those, you know, just really short durations?
Very good. Yeah. Very good. The metaphor, I think, that captures it as well as I can get, because often I just need to go to metaphor to, it seems to be the most helpful didactic approach, is if you look up into the sky and you see that there are like three layers of cloud. I mean, there's low light level and the medium level and then high cirrus clouds way up there, 30,000 feet or whatever. And there's a full moon. And so you're looking through layers, you know, looking through the layers, looking up in the night sky, and it's really very dark. But through these layers of clouds, if you look and then you say, ah, and you know it's a full moon night, ah, yeah, the moon's right over there. You can see it, it's brighter over there, right? And let's imagine you're correct, that, yeah, that the light from the moon is getting through all those layers of clouds, and right where you're pointing, you say, I can see the moon is right over there. You are pointing in the right direction, so your words must be true. If you say, I see the moon and it's there, and the finger's pointing in the right direction, then they can't be false. If you point in a different direction, then you're false. And so one can say, well, all right, as you're looking up at the night sky and you're seeing the moon's there, are you seeing the moon? And bear in mind, there's three layers of clouds. I would say, yeah, otherwise you wouldn't point your finger in the right direction, right? Yeah, you're seeing the moon. Are you seeing the moon very clearly? No, you just see it's a little bit brighter over there, right? Now imagine as you just stay out there at night and you're gazing at the moon through all these layers, then one layer of cloud just drifts away, and now you're looking at only two, and now you can see there's actually a round white spot. You're seeing the moon now too. And then another layer goes, and now it's quite clear, quite white, just one thin layer of maybe cirrus clouds. And now you can see that you really can see the moon. And then the cirrus clouds go away, and now it's just one of those crystal clear nights where you just feel there's just nothing in between you and the moon. And now you see it, you see the various markings, the shadings of the moon and so forth. You're seeing the moon. So you're seeing the moon all the way along. And so, but you see its gradations. But you did see the moon. That wasn't something else. And you did point in the right direction. So let's phrase your question just a little bit differently. And that is, when we're doing the settling the mind, and you attend to those intervals between thoughts, and you do get 2 seconds here, 3 seconds there, and you just do have a clear sense that you're attending to space, and it is mental space, it's not any other kind of space, it's space, are you seeing the substrate? Yeah, like you're seeing the moon through three layers of clouds. And why? What is the cloud business? Well, the cloud business is that there's a lot more going on from the subjective side than just straight, unmediated substrate consciousness. So if we shift over into the Pali terminology, the term that I think actually is equivalent to this Alaivijnana from the Dzogchen tradition is the Pali term bhavanga. Bhavanga. And I think it's literally and accurately translated as ground of becoming. It is the ground out of which javana emerge. And javana are all the activities of the mind. Sensory perception, imagination, emotions and desires and memories and all the other stuff, all the kinetic energy of the mind, that comes under the category of javana. When all of the javana have subsided, they've all gone dormant, what's left over is bhavana, the bhavanga. Right? And so that's what's left over when you're in deep sleep. There's just no activity. The senses have all imploded. The mind is quiet, calm. So your mind has imploded into a bhavanga. Right? Or if we shift back over to the Dzogchen tradition, Alaivijnana, substrate consciousness, then there are no layers of clouds. There is just, you've reduced to substrate consciousness. So when you're attending there, is that the substrate? Yes, it is. But it's veiled by the fact that your mind still is operating out of psyche. It's still operating out of the coarse level, right? You're still very aware of the environment. There's still bound to be some, you know, conceptual structuring of experience. The mind is still quite active, right? And so you're getting it, but it's veiled. So what you're attending to, that space, that is the substrate, but it's veiled by grasping, by various javana, the activities of the mind. And likewise, the mind that you're attending with, when you're just really quiet, in those brief intervals, what you're attending to is a vacuity, and your awareness of it is just quiet, that is non-conceptual and clear. Are you attending with the substrate consciousness? Yeah. And without mediation? No. Because again, you're not deep asleep, you're not dead, and you haven't achieved shamatha. Those are the three classic ways to just have your mind simply be reduced to substrate consciousness. So you are attending to the substrate with the substrate consciousness, but the substrate that is appearing to you is veiled by layers of grasping, conceptualization, and so forth, and the awareness with which you're attending to that space is the substrate, but it's also veiled, veiled and veiled and veiled. And so the Tibetan word, the Tibetan phrase, settling the mind in its natural state, it's quite a close translation. It could be even a little bit more literal. The Tibetan is Sem Neldu Bapa. Sem is your mind, your ordinary mind. Nel is this uncontrived state, this natural state, this ground state, substrate consciousness. And Bapa means to descend, literally means to fall. Okay? It's letting your mind fall, descend to its ground state. And how does that happen? By releasing grasping. And it's not only the obvious, it's not only releasing grasping onto thoughts and memories and emotions and desires, all the javana, it's also releasing grasping onto dullness and laxity. Releasing the grasping even there. So it's releasing the grasping, the identification, the cognitive fusion with both excitation and laxity. Releasing that, then your mind, having been released, dissolves, and finally it descends and comes plunk. It's not an infinite descent, it's a finite descent. And it comes, and like a stone falling through water and then finally coming to the bed of the lake, let's say. Then it's settled. And then all that's left of your mind is that from which it arose, the substrate consciousness. And all that's left of appearances is that luminous space out of which they arose. Right? So something I think very helpful to bear in mind is that even now, during presumably the waking state, I'm going to go out on a limb and imagine we're not dreaming right now, that all the appearances, the visual appearances of this room and the surrounding environment, all these appearances, the visual, but also the auditory and the tactile, and if there were incense here, the fragrance, if we are munching something, the taste, all of these appearances of the environment, they're all emerging from the substrate. They're not coming from photons. Those images are not coming carried by sound waves. They're not intrinsic. They're not held inside the molecules that we smell and pick up a fragrance, right? These appearances are not coming from physical stuff. They're not even emerging. I'm completely persuaded of this, although there are certainly grounds for debate. I'm completely persuaded that these appearances, the colors that we see, the sounds we hear, they're also not emerging from the chemicals or the electricity inside the brain. I've studied, it doesn't make any sense. There's nothing about molecules or electricity that would suggest they're going to spit out appearances. It's magical thinking. It's very, very common now, but I think I find it completely magical thinking. The notion that appearances actually emerge from a space, a luminous space of awareness, that to my mind makes really good sense. And in fact, the appearances themselves are nothing other than configurations of that space. It says in the Vajra Essence, one text that I translated, that all these phenomena are arising from space and they consist of nothing other than configurations of space. Right? So when all the configurations have dissolved, then you're left just with the space. So the difference between shamatha and falling asleep is, in simply falling asleep, we have a cognitive fusion with dullness, the loss of clarity. And so we pull the wool over our eyes. And as we fall asleep, we also go, clarity is gone. Get there by way of shamatha, clarity is there. And of course, it's increased clarity. And then there's a middle ground. I mean, of course, the whole trajectory of 9 stages leading to shamatha, especially from stage 4 onwards, is an ongoing, very explicit increase of clarity, vividness, luminosity. Yeah, that's really clear, because you're overcoming now explicitly coarse, medium, subtle laxity. You're pulling away like layers of an onion, pulling away, unsheathing the natural luminosity of your own awareness. So that gets brilliant. It gets very, very luminous. So there's that route, that's the long and hard route of, you know, practicing and achieving shamatha. But there's a middle ground, and that's being in the midst of a lucid dream. So you're dreaming, and you know you're dreaming, and then running an experiment. And you may have heard of this one already. It's a very, if you're lucid and you can sustain that lucidity, this is not a difficult experiment to run. And that is get really lucid, you know, be in the midst of a dream and really know it, and then run an experiment. And that is, in the midst of your lucid dream, stop everything. Just don't pay attention to anything, don't think anything, and don't do anything. Just flat out stop. You can even close your eyes if you like, in the dream. In a matter of seconds, the whole dream will vanish. Probably not a lot. You probably won't have to wait 30 seconds. It will vanish. The whole dreamscape, including your dream body, will all vanish. All the appearances will be gone. And what will be left? The substrate with no appearances. And the clarity that you already had in the dream. If you maintain your lucidity, if you maintain that flow of knowing the dream as the dream, and then the dream vanishes, then you'll know the substrate as the substrate. So not with the how do you say, the enormous clarity or luminosity of having gotten there by way of shamatha, but not with the dullness of getting there by way of falling deep asleep to ordinary, with the level of clarity you have right now. And with that degree of clarity, you'll be able to illuminate the substrate and get a pretty good idea. Yeah. So one of my students recently, she's been practicing a long time, but just a month or two ago, she came to me, she was so happy. Really, she's ebullient, I think is the word. She's just bubbling over. She's really happy. And she said, I really had a breakthrough last night. She was in the midst of a lucid dream. She released, I think that's how she got into it. It was the easiest way. And then she slipped into lucid, dreamless sleep. And she was able to maintain it for 2 or 3 hours. And she said it was just a breakthrough. And it was blissful. It was blissful. So, that's interesting. Okay? Good. It's 6 o'clock. So, all that food prepared by so many people. Time to gratefully enjoy the meal.